Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
And the award goes to the War Report for the best radio talk show. I guess we're on radio, not television or movies. But anyway, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition to the War Report. As I said last week, I was so rushed trying to get probably what should have taken four shows into first 55 minutes end up being 45 minutes. And so I'm going to, as I stated last week, try and do a redo, basically, hoping that you remember some of the things from last week. I'll give some of the essentials and then add some things that I would have added had time not been pressing, and then go forward from there. To summarize, what we're doing here is we're looking at the history, to some extent, of the rise of racism in this country, its impact, its importance, its effect on both African Americans and white, and really how it has lasted so long. August the 20th, they say, 2019 will be the 400-year anniversary of the Africans landing somewhere near the shores of Jamestown in Virginia. And within, say, 50 years or so of the landing, we have the beginnings of formal racism in the form of the slave laws that were developed. We have the beginning of a divide and conquer strategy that was implemented so very well and led to what we have today in terms of the huge divisiveness and race relations between black and whites, and whites and other groups as well. But all of those things had, I'm arguing here, and the literature backs me up on that, had its genesis in early day colonial America. Very quickly, remember that the first group of whites to come to the shores of Virginia was in 1606, three ships carrying 100 settlers from England arrived, Chesapeake Bay. They left England in 1606. They arrived in, say, Virginia, May 24, 1607. And you recall from the first show in this series, I talked about the hardship that these early settlers experienced. And I even mentioned the starving time, where the people, the first people who came, they, as I had mentioned in the past, they were from the cities. They knew nothing about farming. They knew nothing about growing food, how to protect themselves during the winter, and they had a rough time. Native Americans helped out. It was a boat-friendly, I won't say relationship, in the early years. Some 1619, some 12 years later, when the first Africans arrived on scene. And I told you during that first episode of this series that the Africans, they experienced a mixed lot of things. Some we know now were indentured servants, put into indentured servitude. We also learned that at least two were put into slavery for life, but eventually that changed. And we also know that the arrival of those first Africans turned out to be a tremendous blessing for the people in the colonies. Those Africans brought skills, knowledge that they were able to share with the people in the colony, and they helped tremendously in the colony stabilizing, starting to thrive, and they became, from what the records that I've seen recently, they became an integral part of the colony. I want to go as far as saying almost on an equal basis. Some of them had bought their own farms. Some of them had indentured servants that were white and black. Some of them bought their freedom because they were allowed to make money, I guess, in their spare time under their terms of their contract. They did well given the time and the circumstances. They helped the colonists when they were fighting off the Native Americans and the various skirmishes and wars that they had. Some rose to prominent positions of power and influence. And the list kind of goes on for that, say, from the 1619 up to maybe 1660s and 1670s. Some things started to happen. One, going back, England had a new king who looked favorably upon England getting involved in the Atlantic slave trade market. Before that, the planters and the colonies, or Virginia and then later Maryland, they had to depend on the Spanish and the Portuguese to bring slaves to the two colonies for purchase. But when England said it was okay for English ships to get involved directly with African slave trade, bring their purchases to the colonies, sell them, there was sort of an explosion of the number of slaves in a very short period of time after this. One estimate says that the white population grew 5%, whereas the slave population grew 10% in a relatively short period of time, and that the introduction of the additional slaves brought about greater greater growth and richness for everyone. And things started to change as the number of slaves increased. And I want you to keep that in mind, because that would be a situation for the next almost 400 years. As the slave population would increase, as the black population of free slaves would increase, you will see the reaction a little later on. And I'm going to give you a little clue. The reaction that I'm going to talk about would be the kind of reaction that we would see for almost 350 years. Okay. Now, what I didn't get a chance to say last time that I think was crucial, I want to go back to Aristotle and his period. Remember I talked about Aristotle, and I said that Aristotle came up with this climate theory that would explain why some people were white, some people were middle-ish, and some people were black. And he basically said that in those areas where you have extreme climate, like hot climates, that would account for the black people. Those climates at extreme cold climates, that would account for the extremely white, pale population. Of course, Greece was a sort of like middle climate, which he considered to be perfect. And he said it was because of that that the Greeks were endowed with abilities, with intelligence that you didn't find in the two extreme climate and the population of those two extreme climates. Of course, he was a person who thought Greece was the say-all, be-all of all times. Very, as someone said last week, I think it was Sheila, very ethnocentric in his views. And hence, he had the climate theory. In this theory, he also had what become known as a human hierarchy. This would be that people like the Greeks were intellectually, physically, and morally superior to those who were from the two extreme climates, extremely cold, extremely hot. Also, the Greeks were beautiful people, whereas the people from the two extreme climate, they were ugly and lacked the capacity of freedom and self-government. Greeks had those things. They had the notion of citizenship and freedom and the notion of self-governance, and such that Greeks were the sort of, I want to use the word chosen people, that would come a little later, but basically you get the idea that the Greeks were, I almost said something that was a slang, but the Greeks were the I can't even get it out anymore. But anyway, Greeks were the superior people. But and also, in the superior climate, as I said, Greeks were to be endowed as superior rulers and enslavers of the world. Let me say it again. The Greeks were not only, or they're going to be the beautiful people, the most beautiful people. They're going to be endowed with superior rulers and enslavers of the world. This notion of empire and that they were destined to rule the world and to enslave the rest of the world. So we have here two things. Humanity is divided into two, the masters and the slaves. And guess who the Greeks were? The Greeks were the masters. The rest of the world were barbarians. And because the Greeks would be the masters, they had the right to command. Those who were born had the obligation to obey. You can see here racial ideologies forming. You can see the idea of whiteness forming. And you can see from Aristotle and the people of his generation this notion of there were differences between groups of people, and that these differences were mattered, they were significant, because these differences reveal special endowment. They would reveal also that this special endowment was not universally spread among all groups. This is an idea This is a social construction. This is something that's made out of, for the sake of lack of a better term, whole cloth. But Aristotle, as you already know, was an extremely revered person as a philosopher. And the Greeks would become extremely revered people. And their lifestyle, their contribution to the growth of civilization were considered the end-all, the be-all. The Romans, after the Greeks, would also adopt the Greeks' climate theory and human hierarchy, social constructs. And here's something that I said last week, and I'm going to repeat it. Both Rome and Greeks had slaves. Both Greek and Rome were developing justification for slavery. In other words, what they were saying was slavery was considered maybe a bad thing, but it was okay for the Greeks and later the Romans to have slaves because there was this notion of a human hierarchy. They were at the top of the chain, and all the other people were at the bottom. Hence, there seemed to be this notion that of entitlement, or should we call it for what it really was? White privilege? So, you have this, and as I mentioned, these ideas would eventually make their way to Europe and the various countries that would make up, quote, for back then, modern-day Europe. There were people in England who would hear the stories from travelers and explorers about the different kinds of people that they would encounter, and they would hear the story eventually about Africa, about China, and other places, and they would take these gossipy reports and adapt them to their own belief system. I'm truncating this part so that there were people when the first set of pilgrims almost, they weren't the first people, came over, they brought some of these ideas with them. And later on, in particular, one very, very, very important Christian leader or theologist, Richard Mathers, I should say, and then eventually his two or three sons, who were Puritans, would bring Aristotle's ideas, his theory, climate theory, and his human hierarchy with them to the New World. The father, Richard, he was a student of Aristotelian classic philosophy, and he knew it backwards and forwards, you want to say. He brought it with him, would be some years later. Now, you get to people coming, and we get the pilgrims coming over, and you know that they came over, I think the first people came from England was in 1607 or 8, and then the pilgrims would come, and then the Africans, and then it goes on from there. As I said in the first show, the first group of Africans, and I just said at the top of this show, they were received and treated differently. The way in which they were treated would be markedly different some 40 years later. 50 years later. Part of the reason that they would be treated differently is that, as I mentioned also at the top of the show, when the colonies, or the colony of Virginia first, started to prosper, when they started being able to grow crops, sell them abroad, making money for the king, making money for the Virginia Company, making money for themselves, there was a huge demand for labor. Again, they brought in more white indentured servants, they brought in more blacks, and of course, they would soon discover that it was more profitable to bring in more blacks than white indentured servants. White indentured servants would serve a term of 3, 5, 7, 9 years, and they would be free. But the Africans, you could keep them in servitude for a longer period of time or in perpetuity. So, the stage is being set now. Also, during this time of prosperity, I'm going to use the term greed. I don't know if other people would agree with me, but people were making money, lots of money, and they wanted to make more money. Practices, labor practices shifted. The owners, slave owners, the people who had the indentured servant contract, they were trying to get more and more production out of their labor force. They started treating their labor force less kindly if they ever did. And something happened. People got pissed off. And in the 1670s, there was an incident where, by that time, I should say, the native population, the relationship between the settlers and the native population had gone south. There were wars, skirmishes. There was a big, big skirmish that took place. The native population did a surprise attack on the settlers, massacring a large number of them. And the governor of the colony, Virginia, really didn't do a lot. The settlers were demanding that they do something, but they didn't, because he had an economic agreement with the Indians that he didn't want to disturb. And as a result, some of the settlers got together and they formed their own army, their own militia. This would become extremely, extremely huge. What would happen would be this. A leader would come out of this group, a guy named Bacon. I think last week I was pronouncing it Beacon for some reason, but Bacon. He became the leader of a group, and one of the things that he did, he realized that there were many groups of dissatisfied people. He went out and he recruited slaves. He recruited sympathetic, free blacks and whites. He recruited exploited white servants. He recruited religious dissidents. He recruited the vulnerable small farmer. And he brought them into one big army. He would then go out and take on, in a six-month battle, the native population that was responsible for the massacre and other indigenous people there. And then, and this is kind of brilliant for him, he decided that with his army, he would march on the capital. He had enough people and they had the skills, now the weapons, all that stuff that you need. And they marched on the Capitol. It would become the first large-scale American Revolution in the colonies. And this took place in 1676. What I want you to remember was that this guy was able to recruit from many different groups. And most importantly, blacks and whites. That would be something, the consequences of which I'm holding back on, because that's basically what the rest of the show is going to be about. But take my word for it. That was huge. Okay. So, we have then the Bacon Rebellion. It succeeded. He drove the governor into sort of like hiding exile. They burned down Jamestown. I don't know if you know that from your history, but they burned the city down. And he was a hero. But the hero got sick, got a disease, and he died. The governor got the king to send some forces. They came back. They took on the rebellion and basically ended in a stalemate. But because the leader had died, many of the people gave up, and a truce was negotiated between the former governor and his commander of the troops that he sent to sort of like take back the city. And the truce was worked out, and the rebellion was over, but not really. The Jamestown ruling class. Yes, there was a ruling class, equivalent to, I guess, our 1% of the day. They learned something from the rebellion. And what they learned was they had to separate the blacks from the whites. Because the black and the white, the poor whites, had so much in common that there was a basis for them uniting and pursuing goals that were in their own interest. And of course, as I said earlier, both the white population of indentured servants had grown, but the African population had grown even more. And of course, they were anticipating even further growth of the Africans. It became a necessity that the Africans in this rebellion, they had to take steps to prevent future coming together of Africans and whites. So, 1670, after the rebellion was over, the elite did not keep their word in the terms of their agreements with the rebels, and they started a campaign. And here's how the campaign went. One of the first things they did was Africans could no longer own white servants. All servants had to be Christians. And Christian became synonymous with whiteness. All servants not being Christian would be slaves for life. All non-baptized Africans coming into Virginia would be slaves for life. They forbid the free slaves from carrying weapons. They wanted to have all of the, if possible, any slave owner who were to set his slaves free had to relocate the slaves out of the colony at his or her own expense. I shouldn't say her because women didn't have the status of being free. They outlawed mixed marriages. Children of mixed marriages were to be servants for 30 years. That's what they did to the Africans. Now, here is the coup de grace here. They had to, in their mind, they had to do something for the poor whites to make this separation attractive. So what they did was they changed the laws, or they created laws. They used a divide and conquer strategy, one that would create more white privileges for poor whites. One of the first things that they did was they pardoned all of the poor white rebels, as opposed to their original agreement that all the rebels would be pardoned. They didn't pardon the black rebels. For the black rebels, they prescribed 30 lashes, and from that time going forward, any slave who lifted a hand against any Christian would be punished. That punishment would be lashing, and it could be up to death. Listen to what I just said. If you were a slave and you lifted a hand against any Christian, and remember, Christian now is whiteness, you were punished. This is the equivalent of making every white person superior to every slave. And slave now is going to be black people. This means that, as we would come to see later in the South during the 1800s and early 1900s, that any white person was superior to any black person. And I think I mentioned several times different examples where if white person's walking down the sidewalk, black person's walking down the sidewalk, black person have to step off the sidewalk and let the white person pass. That white person could be a 5-year-old, 100-year-old, it didn't matter. The person was white. Black person had to yield to that whiteness. A white person could inflict violence on a black person, and much like today, there was no penalty. We see that with the Stanier Brown laws and Trayvon Martin shooting. We see it in other instances where unarmed black boys, men, killed, and there's no punishment for it. This was directly related to whiteness, and it comes right out of this period of the late 1600s. What I'm saying is that white, poor whites, had risen in their own, from their own lowly place or station and a new slave society. I want to say this again. When you have white indentured servants, you have black indentured servants, when you had free blacks, and there were some Native Americans there too. White indentured servants did not have a status that was higher than the other groups or individuals that I just mentioned. I want to say that they were on an equal plane. That may be stretching it a little bit, but they were more equal than unequal. We flip the script on it now. Any white person has a higher status than any non-white person, any non-Christian. Any Christian had a higher status than any non-Christian or even black Christian. Also, in doing this, the elite, they began to arm defenders. They became, I should say, the other way around. This new class of white became the armed defenders for the planter elite or the elite power structure. This is probably the most important thing that I can say right now is that what I'm saying is that they took the rebels, the white rebels, they came up with the laws creating a new social class. It would be lower class whites. It would be the beginning of a formalizing a social structure of what would become America. Because what had happened when the whites and the blacks united, they didn't unite on the basis of skin color. They united on the basis of class issues. The poor class being mistreated by the rich class. The same phenomena that would take place almost 100 years later in a little place called Paris and the French Revolution, same dynamics. As a result of creating this class and putting them against each other, you would see the beginning of one, animosity, bitter animosity between the poor whites and the enslaved blacks, an animosity that would do nothing but grow over the decades and over the centuries. And I said, I don't want to belabor the point, but this is the beginning of white privilege. This is the beginning of formalized white racism. And to make sure that this class would be distinct, some more things happened. One of the things was that each, almost, I want to say, like county in colonial Virginia had to create a militia. And the new poor white class had to serve in this militia. Later, this militia would become what was known as slave patrollers. What are we talking about here? The ruling elite comes up with a plan that totally flips the script. I'm saying that again. They give the poor class some privileges, Now, they make them their defenders. They're creating what I referred to earlier as a buffer class. A class that would reside between the blacks and the upper elite whites by taking the poor whites who had many things in common with the black slaves, free slaves, and separating them. As I mentioned, the patrollers had to serve in the military. They had complete power over blacks, free or otherwise. They were, quote, now better off than any non-white person. Today, we see and we know of the white poor class, different terminology, what is it, white trash, trailer trash, hillbillies, rednecks, and other derogatory terms to describe this group. This class, this new class of, I'm going to call them Americans at this point, is present today. It has evolved from the late 1600s, I'll say the middle 1600s, to today. We knew them back in the 1970s, 1980s, and the Farwell, Jerry Farwell, moral majority. We know them now in Trump's army. We would come to know them the Civil War. We would come to know them in the early 1900s, and we would especially come to know them in the periods after World War I and World War II, and into the 50s, the 60s, into the present day. What I'm trying to say, and why I believe what I've said thus far and left of the time that I have is so important, is that I look at those events that I just described as setting in motion an ideology that I mentioned last week that I call the rightness of whiteness. It's an ideology. It's a set of ideas. It's a set of beliefs, set of values, set of attitudes that give rise to a set of behavior, none of which is innate to the human species, all of which are socially constructed by humans to sort of like give a framework for their reality. We know from our study of social sciences, and particularly psychology and social psychology from the psych side, that attitudes, beliefs are very hard to change. Behavior, on the other hand, can be modified. You know, if your teachers are listening, you know, parents, behavior modification, we use it in school all the time, how to modify a behavior. Even the Arizona senator who ran for president, Barry Goldwater, and one of his famous statements was that you can't legislate morality. In other words, what people believe, what they value, what they think, their attitudes, and et cetera. I'm saying that the racism that we see today, the classism that we see today, the intersectionality, that's a word that people now love to use in academia, and that only means when you get two variables, three variables, four variables coming together, intersecting, they can create a sort of phenomena that either one of the variables alone couldn't create. But this intersectionality here is where we are today. And it has its genesis almost as far back as Aristotle. It has survived. It has survived. What? How many years ago was the Greek Empire and Aristotle? How many years ago from the start of Christianity? How many years ago the French, the English, and the Portuguese, all the people who were involved in slavery and involved in creating the justification based upon perceived racial differences, primarily skin color, and then creating around those perceived differences this socially constructed ideology that basically said the differences mattered, the differences had important implications in terms of morality, in terms of intelligence, in terms of beauty, in terms of hardworkingness, in terms of being capable of self-governance, and on and on and on. These things, what has their genesis back then, are present now. So for me, Bacon, when he was able to pull together all the various groups that I just mentioned, he did something that scared the crap of the power elite of that day. His act of being able to reach out and pull these people together, keep them together, and the success or successes that they had in fighting Native Americans, fighting the powers that be, burning Virginia. That was such a phenomena that could not be forgotten by the power elite. And their reaction to it and the things that they did in terms of divide and conquer set in motion something that would last the last 350 years. But very quickly, the last part, when I said I would talk about white rage. White rage is a term that people use today, scholars and others, and black rage, the notion of rage itself as an emotional response. What we see in terms of the white people who are out trying to cheer Trump on in terms of exporting the immigrants, the same white people who believe that black people are getting favorable treatment compared to them, and white people who want to pick up arms and support their rightness of whiteness, and et cetera. There's a lot of research that basically has concluded that white rage is not just the physical manifestation of this emotional state. That's the one that we see. We see the people rioting, white people, black people. White rage, that part that you can't see, that part that comes from power, like the power of the president, the power of the Congress, the Senate, the power of the judiciary, the power of state governors, city council, the mayors, and et cetera. The people who are in those power positions, who can make policy, who can make laws, those laws are reaction to black people's gains, black people striving for freedom, black people striving for equality. Throughout the 350 years that I'm talking about here, we can document that when black people begin to show and achieve progress, and especially on any significant scale or measure, there has been this white rage. And I'm saying today that what the legislatures did in terms of divide and conquer strategy was white rage. What we saw in terms of the Civil War, white rage. What we saw, the reaction to the Supreme Court decision to desegregate schools in 1954, the white reaction to that, white rage. What we have seen today, the reaction to the group Black Lives Matter, white rage. I'm told that there's a caller, and I'm going to try and take that caller. Caller, are you still there? Hello?
No, the caller's no longer there.
Okay, caller is gone. So, why this is all important to me, and I said I wanted to do a second show because I didn't do the first show, is what I basically just said. We have seen for over 350 years effort by the white elite to use their powers to separate groups so that those groups cannot come together, join forces, and create a force so strong that it not only threatens but could actually dethrone them from their position. This has been something we have seen for, as I said, all these years, and it's deliberate, it's manufactured. It's like when I talk about the Machiavellian agenda. It is a form of the Machiavellian agenda. Very well thought out, very well executed. So for hundreds of years, generations of the white elite have been able to manipulate poor whites to help keep African Americans and other people of color on the bottom of the heap. They use this manipulation when white immigrants come in from different countries, in particular the European countries, Northern European, Middle Europeans, and now, of course, Eastern Europeans. As long as these immigrants that come in and don't mix with people of color, particularly we're talking about black folks, they are extended white privilege by the white elite in terms of jobs, in terms of housing, in terms of education, et cetera. They get, as long as they can distance themselves from people of color, as long as they don't seek to assimilate, then they get white privilege. So in a sense, I'm also talking about not only the emergence of white racism, I'm talking about the origins or the emergence of whiteness, or what we want, some would want to call now white privilege. And all of it has a racial or racism bias as a door. Okay, next week I will do part four, and then the first week, second week of March, I will do our annual assessment show. And I'm sorry I couldn't get things done last week. I hope I've sort of redeemed myself this week by putting some things in play that I didn't do last week, so that you now would have a more comprehensive picture, and that I believe this show was a linchpin of the first two shows as well as for the last show. The divide and conquer, putting black people and lower class whites against each other and keeping them in that position for the last 350 years. Is probably the most salient thing that can account for our racial divide today. Thanks, everybody, and go watch the Oscars. Bye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.